we have enough visitors, I think I need to take at least a moment to orient us and to make sure we're sort of all on the same page. In our class at this moment in our existence, we're going through the Bible a little bit at a time. And we have started the book of Joshua a week or two ago. And so if you will find the book of Joshua, if you find Deuteronomy, you've got one book to go. If you find Judges, you went one book too far. So if you would find the book of Joshua. We have looked at the first two chapters, and I propose that we take just a moment to summarize what's there before we move on into chapter 3. Those of you who were here last week, if you weren't here last week, you're off the hook. You can just enjoy this next part, grin a little bit that you're not on the firing line. But those of you who were here, how do you summarize chapter 1? First hour did this really, really well. You have a challenge to me. Okay.
Well, God told Joshua that he was the man.
That's the one. First hour did. God said to Joshua, "You the man." What did Joshua hear? What he heard was, "Stand firm, be of courage. You're the one that I'm going to work through." And he said, "Just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you." Look at chapter 1, verse 5. Look at chapter 1, verse 5, middle of the verse. As long as you live, no one will be able to resist you. That's talking about the occupation of the promised land. But look at the next little phrase. I will be with you as I was with Moses. I have a very important question at this point. Is that an analogy? I use analogies a lot in my teaching. Those of you who are visiting may not know this about me. I teach chemistry. And in the process of teaching chemistry, I have to try to help my students learn things. And what I've discovered is chemistry is much harder than German or Russian. If you're trying to learn German or Russian, you already have a sense of what the words mean. You just don't know what the words are, right? If you can figure out what the word is for chair, you already have the idea of chair. In chemistry, you're learning about the same number of new terms, but you have no idea what the terms mean. So you have this sort of double whammy effect. So I try to have people understand this. For example, I talk about the fact that if you have materials that are gases, that implies the particles that they're made of do not have much of an attractive force for other particles, because if they did have some attractive forces, they'd probably be liquids. And if the attractive forces were a little stronger, they might even be solids. And so melting points and boiling points become at least one way of measuring how strong these things are. And trying to get students to understand forces of attraction as opposed to the bonds, this is the hardest thing. The students think that when you melt something or boil something, you're breaking covalent bonds, and you're not. At least almost never are you doing that. Most of the time what you're doing is breaking these forces of attraction. You try to get a sense of the level, the difference of this. And so I make an analogy with the story, the game Red Rover. Did you play Red Rover when you were growing up? Right? You've got a long line of kids over here, the kids over here shout, Red Rover, let Cameron come over. Right? If it happens that over in this line are some girls and they've always wanted to hold hands with Cameron, right? Then when Cameron comes over, they might really hold tightly to try to keep, because if Cameron can't break through, he has to come and hold hands with them, right? On the other hand, he might want to hold hands with them, in which case when he came over, he might not try very hard to break through. The psychology of this game is really interesting, but if you think about it, you know, if you have some people who can grip more tightly, that's a stronger, and that's a parallel to the force of attraction between things. So what if you think about two people deciding they're really going to get this going right, they take super glue and go, and then they hold hands, right? You just up the ante, right? These forces of attraction are really strong. But now, if you think about, and some of my students don't like this part, they think this is a little grisly. Imagine chopping off my hand and chopping off your hand and then Siamese twinning us at the wrist. Now think about breaking through. That's covalent bonds. Covalent bonds, blood's got to flow. You know, you're breaking sinew and tissue. You're not just breaking a grip of some kind. That's analogy, okay? Is this analogy? No, it's not. My love is like a red, red rose. My love is nothing like a red, red rose. Plant versus animal, you know, there's all kinds of differences. But the poet, analogy, metaphor. This is not analogy or metaphor. What is it? It's a promise that the relationship I had with Moses, I'm going to have that relationship with you. So far, okay? Okay, that's chapter 1. But since we've already talked about that, we're going to move on. Chapter 2. What was the subject of chapter 2? Spies? Yeah.
Rahab,
yeah. If you're going to summarize it, what would you say?
Something about the fact that God uses people we don't expect to be used.
Faithful people can pop up in the most unusual places. And we have tender ears here, so I'll have to be a little careful how I say this, but in the middle of a brothel in Jericho, suddenly somebody comes up who turns out to be in the lineage of Jesus. You go to Matthew and suddenly there's Rahab in the middle of the thing. She speaks in ways that somebody could say were self-serving. But if you read carefully what she says, what she's really saying is, I recognize the power of God. I recognize what God is doing. And I don't want to stand in opposition to that. I want to stand in support of that. And I want my family to be there with me. So, that's the first two chapters here. Interesting so far? Maybe. Okay, chapter 3. Chapter 3, verse 1. Early in the morning, Joshua struck camp and set out from where they were. With all the Israelites, they went as far as the Jordan. Mine just says, as far as the Jordan. What is the Jordan? That's a river. What's our river?
It's a creek.
The James. Right? If we say, I'm going to go down to the James. Okay? In your case, you just say river, and everybody understands it's the York or it's the Pamunkey or it's whichever one your boat's anchored on. But they're going to go to the Jordan. It says they went as far as the Jordan, and there they camped before they crossed. 3 days later, the officials went through the camp and gave the people these instructions. When you see what?
The Ark of the Covenant.
Mine has, it almost sounds like a rhythm to it. It almost sounds like you want to chant it or put it into a song, Raz. The Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God. The Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God. Right? Now, I want you to notice something as you pass by this spot. What did chapter 1 have? God says to Joshua, you're the man. But he doesn't say, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, my God. He doesn't take pride in what God says. He keeps identifying God with the people and the people with God. I think there's something very admirable about the way Joshua works here. When you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priests, you will leave your position and follow it. Now, what's your position? If you remember, the campment was the Ark of the Covenant goes in the middle, and then the various tribes have sections that are all around it. And when the Ark gets up to go, then everybody sort of falls in place behind it, right? So this is nothing new, except for the phrase that ends the verse or starts the next verse. When you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priests, you will leave your position and follow it. So that. Does yours have a so that at that point? Does it have it down in verse 4 somewhere?
However. No.
Okay. Here's what mine says. You will leave your position and follow it so that you may know which way to take since you've never gone this way before. And then it goes on to say between you and the ark, keep a certain distance, and the distance is maybe 3,000 feet. I want to make sure you see what I think is being said here. I have to admit, I've never heard anybody talk about this before, but I think it's here. First of all, does your translation support what I just read? Do you have the pieces of what I just read scattered somewhere in there? When you see the ark begin to move, you get up and leave where you are and follow it so that you'll know which way to go because you haven't been this way before. Right? The ark has been moving for 40 years, or at least for 38, right? And the people have been following it for 38 years. Why does he say today? Because it's going to a place and you don't know where you're going. How big was the area that they've been wandering in for 40 years? Starts with N. Not very big. How do you wander for 40 years and never follow the same track twice? Answer starts with why. You don't. this time, you got to make sure you get up and follow. Because you're not going to know where you're going. Because you haven't been this way before. I have this picture that for 40 years, they've been passing the same place a few times. Nobody's told me that, and I don't see it specifically addressed, but it's not a very big area. How long would it have taken when they crossed the Red Sea, how long would it have taken for that people to move from there to the Promised Land? It told us back in the first five books of the Bible, 11 days. If they had wanted to just go 11 days, how long have they been wandering? 40 years. 40 years. In what area? In a desert. Right? What have they been eating for 40 years?
Manna.
And manna means?
Rough.
What's this stuff? A very rough but accurate translation is, what's this stuff? What have they been drinking?
Water.
Where'd they get the? From a rock. And over in the New Testament, it hints that the rock is following them. I don't understand that either. For 40 years. And this day, he says, when the ark gets up and starts to move, you follow it because you may not know which way to take.
I don't think he's just talking about geography.
Because you haven't been this way before. I don't think he was either. Did you go to the worship service this morning? What was the subject of the pastor's remarks? He dropped his series for a couple of weeks in order to talk about
Macedonia.
Multi-site, new opportunities. What direction do we take? And right now, he is saying, I think I know, but it's not my decision to make. It's our decision to make. And if we don't keep close to the Lord's leadership, to let the Lord tell us which way to take, chances are we're going to go the wrong direction. And we haven't been this way before. There's a tie between this part of this verse and what you heard Travis talking about today, and probably we'll hear him talk about next time.
The 40 years were also required for the disobedient generation to die off. There was only two.
Only two. Now, keep an eye on that, because at the end of this morning, we're going to find something very interesting about that. It's not time yet, but keep an eye on that. Yeah, this is a whole new group. But I'm reading into this, and I freely admit I'm reading into this, but it sounds to me like he's saying, before this, very often, you would know which way you're going, because you sort of recognize the path. I thought there was this wonderful cartoon this week. Did you see the wonderful cartoon this week? The NASCAR GPS.
Oh.
Turn left, just ahead, turn left, just ahead, turn left, just ahead, turn left. I thought that was great. Wouldn't work on the road tracks, but there's only two of those, right? He says, if you don't stay close to the way, direction God is leading you, you may not know which way to take. And you haven't been this way before. I have this picture for 40 years. After a while, they sort of have a sense. And that's, I think, part of what Travis was trying to say. We're about to break out in some new direction. Is this the right direction to take? Is that, what should we do? I loved his imagery. I think he's dead on. We've been looking at what to do about James River. Never really meant to be in a high school at all. I'm not sure that's exactly right. We thought we might be in there a year or two, but certainly not in there for 6 years. And every time we start looking at some place, I'll give you a little clue, we think we found a place. It's going to be a long time before we do anything there. At least we can lock down where the thing is if we do the right steps. But can we do that at the same time we're doing everything else? I don't think I'm giving the school away, but that's what's coming. How can we do this in the face of an economic recession that's cutting down on giving towards the budget? How can we do these things? Which ones do we do? We're at the same kind of crossroads, I think. Now, I'm coming back to this. Between you and the ark, keep a distance of, mine says 2,000 cubits. A cubit is about 18 inches. Technically, it's the difference from the tip of the middle finger of the right hand to the bottom of the elbow of whoever the king is, which means when the king changes, the cubit changes. But that's about 18 inches. That's about 18 inches. Okay, that's about eight. So that's about 3,000. I would have thought 300 feet would have been enough. That would have been a football field, and we've seen the distance on a football field, right? It can sometimes be kind of short. keep a distance between yourselves and the ark. Do not go near it. He then said to the people, my translation says, sanctify yourselves. What is your, what word does your translation use at that point? Consecrate yourselves. Sorry?
Make yourselves holy.
Make yourselves holy. Purify could have been a word that could have been used here, and I think at least one translation does. Okay? What does that mean? It means a process of basically where God is about to take you, you need to have clean hands and clean hearts when you go in those directions. And there's a process of recognizing that and doing something about that that the people would have known. Okay. Sanctify yourselves, since tomorrow the Lord will work wonders. And notice again, he doesn't say through me. What does he say? Among you. His deflecting God's words back towards the people, I think, is very admirable. He then said to the priest, take up the Ark of the Covenant and cross at the head of the people. They took up the Ark of the Covenant and moved to the head of the people. Somewhere in here, we lose a couple of days. Somewhere in here, we lose a day or so. Because he said in verse 2, it was 3 days later, the officials went through the camp, and they said, when you see this thing move, be ready. Verse 6, he says, take up the Ark and cross to the head of the people. I have the feeling this is now the morning of the day when all the big things are about to happen. And I'm not sure exactly how to count the days that are in there. Verse 6, they took up the Ark of the Covenant, moved to the head of the people. Verse 7, the Lord said to Joshua, this very day I will begin to make you great in the eyes of all Israel, so that they will know that, and it's just like chapter 1, verse 5, so that they will know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. So now I give this order to the priest carrying the Ark of the Covenant. When you have reached the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you must halt in the Jordan itself. In place of the word brink, what does yours use?
Bank.
Bank or banks. Edge, yours says. Any other term there? What does the edge of a river look like? Depends on where you look.
Right.
Some places it's just nice and smooth right down to it, right? Other places you might have an embankment that's maybe 3-4 foot high. The only way to get down is either jump or be pushed. Okay? Other places you might have cliffs. But he says to them, when you get to the banks, which implies at least a few feet, don't stop on the banks. Don't stop until your feet are in the water. So far, okay? Verse 7, the Lord said to Joshua, this very day I will begin to make you great in the eyes of Israel. Verse 9, to the Israelites, Joshua then said, this is almost an echo of chapter 1. God speaks to Joshua, then Joshua speaks to the people, and he doesn't carry into his words to the people the arrogance and pride he could carry from what God has said to him. He instead deflects things to the people. Watch how he does this, chapter 3, verse 9. To the Israelites, Joshua then said, come closer and hear the words of the Lord your God. By this you are to know that the living God is with you, among you. God's promise was, I will be with you as I was with Moses. He doesn't say, God said he would be with me. He says, God will be with you, among you. Yes, sir.
The message says, this is how you will know that God is alive among you.
I like that. This is how you will know that the living God is with you, among you, alive among you. Lost my place. And without a doubt, will expel, and he begins to name all the people that are going to go. Verse 11, look, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of the whole earth changed its language just a little bit from where we started, Rez. The Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of the whole earth is about to move into the Jordan at your head. So now choose 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one man from each tribe. As soon as the priests carrying the Ark of the Lord, the God of the whole earth, have set the soles of their feet in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan will be cut off. The upper waters flowing down will stop as a single mass. Verse 14. Mine starts with accordingly. What does yours say?
So it came about.
Okay. Accordingly, when the people left their tents to cross the Jordan, the priests carried the Ark of the Covenant ahead of the people. As soon as the bearers of the Ark reached the Jordan, and the feet of the priests carrying the Ark touched the waters, and mine pauses and has a parenthetical insert at this spot. It says, by the way, the Jordan was at that moment in spate, as it always was during the harvest season. Now, the word spate, S-P-A-T-E, is not one that translates well for modern American ears, so I need your translation.
Flood stage.
Flood stage. What's flood stage on the James River? What's flood stage on the James River? Depends on where on the James River you look. If you look at West Ham, it's a different number than at Pony Pasture. If you look at Pony Pasture, it's a different number than if you're at the Lee Bridge. 7.5 feet at Pony Pasture, I think. City of Richmond has rules. If the James is in flood stage above 7.5 feet, what are the rules? You're not allowed to get in it without a life jacket. Why is that? So they can find you when you get lost. I went into the James at flood stage. I think it was 8.2 feet, something like that. I had on a life jacket. I was with a friend who was almost as big as I was. He had on a life jacket. We had a yellow 20-foot Old Town canoe. If you know something about canoes, a 20-foot is like a bus. We hopped in. We made it approximately 15 yards, and we were in the river. Flood stage is fun. Lots of water moving, lots of speed. As soon as the feet of the priests carrying the ark touched the water, the upper water stood still and formed a single mass over a great distance, and it names the place. I grew up in East Tennessee back during the Depression under monies from the New Deal. They put in a whole bunch of dams to provide electricity to that part of the world. How did they decide where to put the dams? They sort of looked and said, if we put a barrier here, it'll back the water up here, and the shoreline will be here, and this will be flooded, and this won't, right? And sometimes people seeing this coming 20 years ahead, they buy shoreline property that was at that time maybe 10 miles from the river. And now, if you know where to look, you can go and scuba dive, and you can go down, and you see where the old roads were, you can see where the foundations of houses were, if the lake falls in level, you can see these things. That's called impounding a lake. Something like that happened, but no dam was ever built. Mine says it formed a single mass over a great distance. I have this picture of it just sort of filling up the spaces. While those waters flowing down to the Sea of Araba, the Salt Sea, that's what we call the Dead Sea, were completely separated. And the people crossed. Where did they cross? I'm now at verse 17. Facing Jericho, opposite Jericho. Jericho is the big bad place of this part of the world. Fortified city with strong, thick walls, hills on one side blocking the approach of any armed people, and they've got the Jordan River on the other side, which would have been the most protection when it was at flood stage, right? And there were apparently an area of plains, but that's about the only direction an army could run from. So here are the people up on the walls of Jericho looking out, and they see the waters open up. And how many people came across, roughly? 2 million, million and a half, 2 million people. What might that make you think? Well, they'll tell you a little bit later. You don't have to worry about it yet. The Bible will tell you what they thought just in a little while. But anyway, here it comes. The priest carrying the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground where? They put the foot in the water and the waters opened. They walked to the middle of the river. They stood there and the waters stayed open. And off they went. What happened? While all of Israel crossed, mine says, on dry ground, until the whole nation had completed its crossing of the Jordan. Did you say that? Mm-hmm. I used to deliver papers when I was little. Did you guys deliver papers? They've sort of been taken over by people with cars these days. But some of you delivered papers, right? I usually packed all my papers in baskets on a bicycle. I would sometimes walk the bike because it was so unsteady with all that weight. But I remember one day it had been raining cats and dogs, but the rain had quit. And I was, as usual, late because I'd stopped to talk to people along the way. And I saw a shortcut across the Little League field. Little League field had no grass. It was solid clay. It just finished raining, right? I came close to losing my shoes that day. It took me a couple of hours with hose and all that to get all the mud out. I couldn't turn the wheels after a while. I had to just drag the bike because so much You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Okay, I want you to make sure you see this. What did it say? They crossed on? Didn't say they crossed on mud. So two things happened. The water opened up and the ground dried up. And a million, maybe 2 million people crossed.
Not one wet foot.
Didn't even say muddy. I just want to make sure that there's two pieces to this, and if you've ever tried to go across a Little League field on a bicycle right after a heavy East Tennessee rainstorm, you know what that word dry ground means. Okay. What happened to those 12 guys? Did you forget about the 12 guys? Did you remember the 12 guys we just talked about? What about those 12 guys? Chapter 4. When the whole nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord spoke to Joshua and said, choose 12 men from the people, one man from each tribe, and give them this order. And Joshua says, I've already got them. I picked them out before we started to cross. They're waiting right now. What do you want them to do? Hear from the mid-Jordan. Give them this order. Hear from mid-Jordan, from the place where the priest's feet were standing. Take 12 stones, carry them with you, and set them down in the camp where you pass the night. Joshua called the 12 men whom he had selected from the Israelites, one man from each tribe, and Joshua said to them, go on ahead of the ark of the Lord your God into the mid-Jordan, and each of you take one stone on his shoulder, corresponding to the number of the tribes of Israel, to make this a sign among you, and when in the future your children ask you, what do these stones mean to you? Then here's what you tell them. And what's their description? What you've just seen.
Tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord.
When it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the river separated. And these stones are an everlasting reminder to the people of Israel. What do these stones mean? We maybe don't do that enough. We've got a few. We've got a few places where we set up a monument or a memorial. If you've ever been to Gettysburg, if you've ever been to Vicksburg, been to other places like that, on a quiet day, there's a few monuments there. It's interesting from we're remembering the Civil War in these days. It's interesting to see how close the monuments of the Union forces and the Confederate forces are just placed side by side. Side by side. What do these stones mean to you? We don't make enough memorials. I'm as guilty of that as you are. We don't make memorials. Things that would allow our children to say, what does this mean? The Israelites did as Joshua ordered. This is verse 8. They took 12 stones from the mid-Jordan, corresponding to the number of tribes of Israel. Just as the Lord had told Joshua, they carried them over to the camp and set them down there. That's the end of verse 8, right? Okay. So, the nation has crossed. The 12 guys each carried their stone across. That leaves Joshua and the ark and the people who are carrying the ark in the mid-river, right? Verse 9. One more thing happens. Verse 9. What happens? Joshua alone, as far as I can tell, picks up how many stones?
12
of them. What does he do with them? He builds a memorial right there. They have two memorials, not one. One's in the middle of the river, and one is where they spent the night, the first night on the other side of the river. Everybody agree? The end of verse 9 says something very interesting. They're still there today. At the time this was written, they're still there. How would they know the stones were still there in the middle of the river? Some enterprising young man who was disobeying his mama went out to the middle of the river and dived down holding his breath, and son of a gun, there they are. And maybe he didn't go when it was at flood stage. Maybe he picked a day when the water level was down a little bit. Or maybe every once in a while the waters of the Jordan weren't muddy and whatever. Maybe they were clear and you could actually see them. But they're still there. Two stones. Verse 10, the priest carrying the ark stood still in the mid-Jordan until everything had been done that the Lord had ordered Joshua to tell the people, in accordance with everything Moses had ordered Joshua. And the people hurried across. When the people had finished crossing, the ark of the Lord then crossed with the priest to the head of the people. The sons of Reuben, the sons of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh crossed in battle formation at the head of the Israelites, just as Moses had told them. 40,000 warriors in arms, they crossed in God's presence, ready for battle toward the plain of Jericho. Pause for a second. If you were here last week, you may remember that we talked about the fact that there were some tribes whose portion was on the eastern side of the Jordan. And God had said, you don't get to say, I'm here and I'm not going to worry about anybody else. You go with them. You send the fighting men with them and you take the front. And that's what, it's the fulfilling of that you're seeing here. These are the tribes. The women and children would have stayed behind, but the fighting men would have gone across. So if you were on the battlements of Jericho, what would you have seen? The waters open up, some crazy people carrying a big box come to the middle, and then 40,000 armed soldiers come across, and then 2 million people behind them. Okay. Verse 14, on that day the Lord made Joshua great in the eyes of all Israel, who respected him as they had respected Moses. Another translation said revered. Does yours say revered?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, that's not the end of the verse. The verse says about four more words. What does the rest of the verse say?
Just as they revered Moses.
Yes, but there's a little bit more. As long as he lived. Joseph saved Egypt. Egypt was facing 7 years of famine. God allowed Joseph to see that. Pharaoh put him in charge, and Egypt survived, and survived well, that famine. Joshua was revered and honored in his lifetime, and maybe for a little bit longer, as long as people remembered him. But the Bible says there came a day when a king arose in Egypt who didn't remember Joseph, and that's when the people went into slavery. There is a tragic message in those last few words. Joshua's life ends. Joshua's influence ends. And tragedy and struggle comes. That's the book of Judges. And that's where we're going to go when we finish this book. This book is the life of Joseph. From the time Moses died. Joshua, thank you. From the time Moses died until the time Joshua died. And once Joshua dies, and once his influence dies, and it doesn't seem to last very long, then all kinds of problems begin. And it is a tragedy that those words are here. We ought to do better than that. The Lord said to Joshua, order the priest carrying the Ark of the Testimony to come up out of the Jordan. And Joshua gave this order to the priest, come up out of the Jordan. When the priest carrying the Ark came up out of the mid-Jordan, no sooner had the soles of the priest's feet touched solid ground than the waters of the Jordan returned to their bed and ran on in flood stage just as before. I will be with you just as I was with Moses. The parallel between those two. Verse 19, it was the 10th day of the first month when the people came up from the Jordan and made their camp at Gilgal on the eastern border of Jericho. As regards those 12 stones which they had taken from the Jordan, Joshua set them up at Gilgal. And he then once again said to the people, when your children ask what these stones mean, here's what you're supposed to tell them. And in verse 23, he says, it was just like when we crossed the Red Sea under Moses. And this happened so that all the people of the earth may know how mighty the hand of the Lord is, and always stand in awe of the Lord your God. Verse 1 of chapter 5, the kings of the Amorites and all the kings in Canaan, what does it say about them? They heard about what the Lord had done, that he had dried up the waters of the Jordan before the Israelites until they had crossed. And what does it say about them?
Their hearts melted.
Mine says their hearts failed. Yours says their hearts melted. And they lost all courage to resist.
This is paralyzed.
Paralyzed with fear. And at that point, there is a very strange and odd 90-degree shift in where the story is going. They suddenly stop, and something else happens. Can you read the next few verses? Bob, we're coming back to what you talked about. Nobody has been circumcised. And the order had been supposed to be circumcised at 8 days of age. Nobody had been. As soon as they cross the Jordan, what's the first thing they do? They stop and circumcise everybody that ought to be circumcised, which I understand is painful. And so it takes a couple of days for them to recover. What day did they come across the Jordan? 10th day of the first month. 10th day of the first month, right? Mm-hmm. So now they've been circumcised, and they're going to rest up from that, recover from that. That's 3 days. What day is it now?
13th.
13th day of the first month. What's supposed to happen on the 14th day of the first month?
Social Security check.
Nice try. Nice try. Nice try. What's supposed to happen on the 14th day of the first month? They're supposed to celebrate Passover. So if you come down to verse 10, verse 8, when the circumcising of the nation was finished, they stayed resting in the camp until they were well again. Verse 10, the Israelites pitched their camp at Gilgal and kept the Passover there on what day? On the 14th day of the month, at evening, on the plain of Jericho. On the very next day, the day after Passover, they ate what the land produced, unleavened bread, and mine says roasted ears of corn, which I don't think is a good translation because corn wasn't known until the communication of the news. Roasted grain, yours says. Parched grain, yours says. Right? And what happened then? Verse 12. What was that signal? The wandering in the wilderness is over. You're in the promised land. And all the things that are necessary for you to be obedient to God have been done. Circumcision has come. Passover has been celebrated. And you're now ready for something new. Barb and I had an interesting conversation this week. Today is Veterans Day, right? If you're an active duty soldier, are you a veteran?
No.
The answer is no. Not until you terminate your service are you a veteran. That's what I tried to say to the Taylors a little while ago. Veterans are the ones who have been in service and have come to the end of that service. What comes to your mind when that time comes? I'm sorry to ask Lee and Connie to think about this one more time. The question is, what's next? That's where the people are. They have known one thing for 40 years, and now suddenly they're going in a way that they don't know, and they don't know where to go for sure unless God is leading them. And the sign of that is that the sustenance, the provision that had been there for 40 years of wandering is suddenly gone. I didn't have time to do this the first hour, but I do here. Are there any parallel moments like this in the Bible? Please say yes, and then we'll go look for one.
Yes.
Okay? Okay. Would you look at the first verse of Isaiah 6? Not even the first verse, the first phrase of the first verse of Isaiah 6. Giving my friends with electronic devices time to find it. Doing okay? Everybody okay? Everybody find it? King James, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw also the Lord. What was special about the year that King Uzziah died? Let me help you a little bit. King Uzziah had reigned for 55 years. 55 years he'd been king. That's a long time to be king, right? He started when he was a kid, which you pretty much have to if you're going to do that for 55 years. He started as a kid, and he did great as long as he listened to God's people who advised him. But there came a point where his arrogance took over, and God punished him with leprosy. One of the few people that the Bible singles out as having had leprosy. And when he contracted leprosy, it was in a very public place. Very public place. And he went into seclusion, and he remained in seclusion while ministers of his administered the country on his behalf. And that had been going on for decades. When he died, suddenly the whole country was uncertain. What happens now? We've got a new king, and we haven't had a new king for 55 years. We've had this caretaker government for 20 or 30 years. What happens now? What happens now? That was when Isaiah had his vision, at a moment of that kind of transition. that kind of transition. That's another one that I know is about the same as this. What you have known for 40 years, that has all ended. You get up that morning. Look at this. 40 years, the people, what do? First thing you get up in the morning, go gather your manna. And I can see them. They get up, they go to gather the manna. There's no manna there. That's a wrenching change. That's what these people are experiencing. What has God said? Stay close to the ark. Stay close to the ark, but not too close. Keep a reverence for the God's leadership. Because otherwise, you're not going to know which way to take because you haven't been this way before. And a new journey is starting. And that's a pretty good place for us to stop. If you're going to be here next week, the assignment is to read the rest of the book of Joshua. The assignment is to read the rest of the book of Joshua. But we've reached a point. The wandering in the wilderness has ended, and it ended 4 days after they crossed the Jordan. What did they do in those 4 days? They finally began to obey the pieces that God had said. These are the things you need to do. Joshua said, sanctify yourselves. They really didn't finish that until now. They've had circumcision, and they've celebrated Passover, and then the manna stops. And now they're off on a new direction. Let's have a word of prayer. Our Father, we thank you for the time you give us. We thank you especially for this time. We pray that at this moment for our church, which maybe doesn't meet this level, but it's still a level that concerns many of us, there are directions that we need to consider which way to go. And more than anything, we want to go the way you're leading us. Make your leadership clear. Help those of us who are trying to hear clearly the directions that you're wanting us to go, the way that you're wanting us to go there. We understand the things that happen will happen because of you and will happen within your will, or else we will be in disobedience. And that's not a place we want to be. We pray that you would take the things we've thought about this morning and put it in the hearts of each person here so that we may understand you and your word a little better. We pray all this in your Son's name. Amen.